everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown. And I have a really, really great guest for us. If you don't know her name, I did. You'll know her face because she's done so many things, and she's just wonderful. Her career has been amazing, and she has so many wonderful stories to tell us. And I want to thank you, Lane Bradbury, Lane, for coming on the show. Thanks so much.
Well, you're so welcome. I've been looking forward to this, talking with you.
Me too. We've had a few hitches in the ride, but we got there, and we're here now.
Yeah, we're on the ride now.
So yahoo!
That's what's important.
Yes, so thank you so much for coming, and I also want to thank my friend and your friend, John, who we love so much, John O'Dowd, for introducing me to Lane.
Well, I mean, this is the way John and I met, was on an interview that he was going to write, and he, you know, so we got to be really, really good lifelong friends from our couple of conversations that we had.
Well, that's what happened to John and I. I had him as a guest. I think he might have been my first guest on this podcast. I've been doing it a year, and his books are amazing, and he's so talented, and he's so sweet. And John and I have become really good friends. I've been so blessed in this podcast to have actually met wonderful people who have become my friends. So, yeah.
I think it's a good way to meet people.
It is. It's a great way.
I've only done that one phone. Well, it was a couple of times that we met over the phone, but and then this. So I haven't done this kind of thing very often, but I was looking forward to this and meeting you. So maybe we'll become good friends too after this.
I hope so, because I love you already from all the things we've written back and forth to each other. Okay. So Lane, tell us about, Lane has never stopped working. You've had an amazing career. Tell us about where you're from and what led you to New York.
Well, I grew up in Atlanta, Georgia, and my first memory really is dancing. I must have been 2 or 3 years old, is dancing on the sofa to classical music that my mother would put on in the den. And I remember one, it's nothing more than just jumping up and down to the music. It's not really dancing. But anyway, right in the middle of my jump, my dance, I looked at my dress and I hated it. And I knew that the fairies would hate it too. And so I got off, I put on my Sunday best dress and came back to my stage and started dancing again in something that was appropriate to who I was and where I wanted to be. I mean, that's just, you know, I don't know that I've ever told that story.
That's so cute though, but you knew you had that thing, just like I did as a kid. But I didn't change my frocks. I kept my regular clothes on. But that you're above me there. I like that you did that. So then you start what kind of dance? Ballet or all sorts?
Oh, ballet. Yeah. Ballet. And then my mother enrolled me in ballet class at 5 years old because I guess I just was always dancing. And I think as a child, she had probably wanted to do that herself and had not been given the opportunity. So she gave it to me and my sister. And so I started with Miss Dorothy Alexander in Atlanta, Georgia. And she was my first ballet teacher. And she was amazing because I had a really vivid imagination if I decided that whatever character I was going to be in ballet class that day, she would adjust the class and make it, you know, about what I brought in.
Wow. Miss like Thing.
Like a fairy or yes. a pony or whatever was going on in my head at that point. And she would just gear the class around it so we'd all be fairies or we'd all be ponies. And she would just, and I know that if she did that with me, she did it with other little girls because she was just that, I was just blessed to have her.
You were because summer taskmasters, you know, they really get at you. Even when you're five, they just yeah. don't know how to deal with kids.
Well,
it's just the dogs.
It was, yeah. Well, she was one of the biggest blessings in my life to have her. So, and I owe so much of what I do and who I am to her.
Did she get to see how well you did?
Well, I danced with the, it was called the Atlanta Civic Ballet. Now it's called the Atlanta Ballet. So I danced, yeah, she nurtured me, you know, getting in, you know, I still have, when I auditioned for the Atlanta Civic Ballet when I was 12, I still have the exam sheet that, you know, says that I had a beautiful arabesque and something about my imagination and, you know, that all those things that I don't remember all of them now, but she knew how she just was so intuitive with not only her knowledge of ballet and the fact that, you know, ballet can be dangerous. It was not dangerous for me because she knew the body and knew what the body should not be doing. So she was my kind of my first blessing, I think, on the road to
your first little angel that you've met. Your angel lady. Your dance
yes.
lady.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So what did you do? Was this a school you got into at 12?
Well, it was the Atlanta, it wasn't the Atlanta School of Ballet then. It was just, I went to Miss Dorothy, you know, I mean, and she had a studio built on into her house in Ansley Park, and it had a huge window that looked out onto beautiful gardens. And so, of course, and it was fairy-like. So I felt right at home. And then the first time I went, I remember there was a big green curtain. And I kept thinking, well, now where are the fairies? Because I thought I was coming there to, and they were going to watch me dance and they were going to make me their fairy princess. But I couldn't find them. And I would slip looks behind the green curtain. And then I thought, well, you know what? You better stop looking and you better start dancing the best you can. So if they are watching you, they are not going to overlook you. So, you know, and then it just, but it's the ballet world and that fairy world of mine have been always, they're just close together, you know?
And you took to it and you liked it because I know it's huge discipline, huge, you know, you have to watch everything, watch how you eat, watch how you, and I know people who were ballet dancers and one of my ex-boyfriend's moms was, she had a dance school here in New York mm-hmm. and one of the brothers married a ballet dancer, and she just sort of like gave it up, started eating, drinking, and was merry, you know, because she used to not eat, you know, and just starve.
Yeah.
So she just went to town quickly.
That part, not over indulging in that area is always something that I've watched, that you just watch and you hate it and you hate it and you hate it. but you just watch it. That's all.
Because you know.
You see what happens when you don't watch it. It's in front of our faces every day, and I don't want that to happen to me.
No, even now, you know, they just keep putting these things in front of our face, and I don't know. I wouldn't have been a good ballet dancer. I tried it once, and I ended up laughing hysterically as I tried to pirouette across the floor. It wasn't for me. Stand-up was for me.
Yeah.
That was for me, doing stand-up.
Well, it's certainly not for everybody.
No, you know? It's hard. And you need such discipline. And how many people make it, Lane? You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, now I go to Broadway Dance Center, and there's every form and shape of male and female in there, mm-hmm. because dance is so broadened out to, you know, hip hop, to whacking, to contemporary jazz. I mean, there's something for everybody. So even if you don't have that perfect ballet body, you can find music and a way that you want to move and a discipline that you love to follow.
Do you go there every day?
Yes, I do.
Wowee. Good for you.
I've been not going on Friday because I just take a beginner class now. I mean, I've had too many surgeries and injuries. I don't really dance, but right. I take bar and I take a basic beginner class, because in a basic beginner class, I can work on my balance. I can move to the music, and it's simple enough that I don't go out of class crying. So that, and then tonight I took a beginner class, but I just take the bar, because once they get in the center, they move too fast and I get frustrated and teary. So
hang on to the bar. Yeah.
Yeah.
You come into Manhattan every day. I could have done it at the other place. So tell us now how you made it, how you got here in New York City.
My parents, because I was such a horrific student and failed everything, I did excel on stage, and I was cast in a play called Ondine, which and I was just natural at that, and I loved it, and it was so easy for me being in that world, and they was smart enough to notice that, and then Miss Dorothy started the first ballet festival for regional companies, and Anatole Chujoy, who was the editor of Dance News, and Mrs. Manchester, who was the editor of Dance Magazine, I think, came there to adjudicate the companies that met to dance in this festival. And my parents went up and asked both of them, what am I going to do with Lane? And they had seen me on stage and they said, let her go to New York. So they did not force me to go to college, which would have just been a total failure.
Big time waste.
Yeah. And so I came as as a 17-year-old to New York City.
Did you know anyone?
No. I mean, I had met Anatole Chujoy and P.B. Manchester, but, you know, and so a couple of times they took me out to lunch, but I didn't know anybody.
Now, you ended up getting into the Actors Studio, correct?
Yes.
And you were the youngest member to this day, right?
No, I think now that there's been somebody younger than me. I don't know who, but I think that's what I heard.
You were 17.
But, yeah, I think they took in somebody that was 16 at some point, but I don't know who it was or anything about it, really.
What do you think about that? The method, the whole nine yards. You must have gone to school with some cool dudes and dudettes.
Well, it seemed natural to me. I mean, I think Lee and they fortified. Well, let me tell you a story that will show it to you. When my parents enrolled me in a pantomime class at Columbia, just so they could tell their friends, you know, Lane's going to Columbia.
Pantomime school.
Yeah. So, and at that class, I met this actor named Tom Wheatley, and he was doing a play called Ario da Coppola. Mm-hmm. And I was just fascinated by him because he was so real. He wasn't acting. He was being. And at one point, he stepped off the stage and started walking on the backs of all the theater chairs up into the theater, still doing the scene. And I was just flabbergasted. And so I just kept watching, and the scene finished, and he left his partner and he started up the aisle to the back of the theater, and I followed him. And when we were back outside of the theater, I went up to him and I said, "Could I tell you something?" And he was tall, and he leaned down, and I whispered in his ear, "I love you." And we became good friends. He became my mentor.
Romantic.
An affair.
Right.
Yeah. He was just my friend. And so he started working with me because I said I wanted to get in an acting class at Columbia. And in order to get in the class, I would have to audition for it. So we chose a scene, Picnic. And
which scene did you guys choose?
Just one where I'm trying to get the guy to stay.
Yeah.
And so I'd seen the movie. So I started trying to act like Susan Strasberg had done the part. And Tom kept saying, "No, trying to explain this and that." And I was getting really frustrated because I couldn't do what he said. And finally, he was supposed to have dinner with me and my chaperone and her daughter that night after rehearsal. And so at one point he said, "Well, I'm going to go." And I said, "But you're supposed to, you said you were going to have dinner. And Mrs. Oldham she's planned fried chicken and
yummy.
And everything. We're having a Southern dinner." And he said, "Well, I'll do it another time." And he left. And I was devastated. And I mean, I thought, well, I've just failed. I have completely failed.
That's more on his part.
And then the telephone rang, and it was Tom. And he was down in the lobby, and he said, "Now, Lane, you see how you tried to get me to stay?"
Ooh, cool.
I said, that's what I was trying to get you to do. Light bulb goes on. You don't copy Susan Strasberg. You bring yourself. And so he then asked me to audition with him for the Actors Studio. Mm-hmm. And I tell about this in my one-woman show, which is called Let Me Entertain You Again. But when we would rehearse, he would fill this suitcase full of different things, and I could open the suitcase and play with them or use them in the scene, or, you know, it just was free-flowing.
Sort of like and improv.
So, yeah, kept an improv nature to it, yeah. Although we said the lines. So on the night, and he discovered that I loved chocolate covered cherries, So on the night of the audition, before we went in, he said, "Lane, now when we go in there, I want you to sit in this big black armchair and don't get out of that chair until I give you the signal." Okay. So the scene started. I said my first line. I went and sat in this big black leather armchair. Tom opened his suitcase and he took out this huge box of chocolate covered cherries and he put them on a little table on the opposite side of the stage. Well, I kept waiting for him to tell me that I could get up and give me the signal that I could get up and go get a chocolate covered cherry, but he never did. So I don't know what I did in that chair, but it must have been something, because the next morning he called me on the telephone to tell me that we had both been taken into the actor's studio, and I was the youngest that had ever been taken in at that point. So I owe so much to Tom.
That
he was just an amazing teacher.
Yeah, that was so good what he did, too, with the – I'm just thinking what a creepy is that he walks out on you and you have this yummy southern dinner. And, boy, he really – that was a great way to teach. That was wonderful.
He made it – you don't forget that, you know. He was making me live life.
Was he much older than you?
He was about 4 years older than me. We're still friends.
He's
not in very good health now, but I talk to him a lot, and he lives in California, so we keep track of each other by phone.
That's good, and it's amazing that you guys stayed friends. Were you in the class? Did you have any stars, you know, of the 50s, 60s, because Marilyn showed up in there. I know James Dean. He died already,
I never met him.
Yeah.
But I did. I mean, Marilyn was there, and she was just, she was so fragile and so beautiful and so delicate. And I always remember her in red stiletto heels.
Really?
I never saw her do a scene there, but, you know, I never went up and introduced myself or anything because, you know, we're all in there together, and I just didn't feel like it would be, or maybe I was too shy. I don't know. I guess, you know, some people could do that, but I didn't because I just didn't.
And she was just this gorgeous woman who was in there, and I would have been thrilled to have met, just to have seen Marilyn Monroe. It would have made me feel good. And I know, I read, she was fragile. She ended up having Paula Strasberg as her acting coach, going to all the movies with her on all the movie sets, much to a lot of people's chagrin. They weren't too thrilled about that.
Well, I don't know why. People's stuff like that just turns me off, you know.
They should mind their own business. So go on, Lane.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell everybody how you were discovered for your first Broadway show. Very, very cool.
You want the whole story? Oh, God. This is also in Let Me Entertain You Again. Once I got in to the studio and was Tom and I were introduced, an actor named Bob Heller and an actress, Loretta Levisey, asked me to do a scene with them. And when I was thrilled to death because, you know, I was here. It was the first day that I was in the studio and somebody asked me to work. And then I read the scene and it was about a young hooker who cussed and kissed. And I was horrified. And so I went up to Bob and I said, "I would love to do a scene with you and Loretta, but I don't cuss and I don't kiss." And the reason I was so adamant about the kissing is because I had fallen in love with a boy named Eddie, and had lost my virginity to him, and we were broken up. And I was at that time, you know, if you weren't a virgin, nobody would respect you. Your husband wouldn't respect you. So this was a secret that I kept hidden. So I was not going to give myself away by kissing somebody. So I said that to Bob, thinking that I was probably not going to be able to do the scene with him. He said, okay, well, that's all right. So we went to work on the scene, and I never cussed, and Bob never kissed me. And then, and it was so much fun. I had so much fun with them. And then then it came the time to do it at the Actors Studio, and it was Lee Strasberg and Elia Kazan. And the scene really went so well, and it was so much fun. And then suddenly Bob pulled me into his arms and kissed me. I was undone. I fell to the floor sobbing, because now I felt everybody will know that I'm not a virgin anymore. And so finally the scene was over, and we got to the end of it, and we got up, and you after each scene, you have to tell what you worked on. And so Bob and Loretta said what they worked on, and then Lee came to me, and I said, well, I'm not so good at kissing, so I'm just not. I guess that's what I worked on, and I didn't do so well. And he said, now you know why we took her into the studio, because I was just I was so unhidden and so
open,
spontaneous, you know. So, and then Kazan saw me in that scene, and then he cast me in JB, in the play JB, with Christopher Plummer and Raymond Massey and Pat Hingle, who was in the studio, and Nan Martin. So I had 7 lines, and you know, I learned so much in JB, because there was no pressure on me to do anything but be Lane. And there was an atomic bomb scene where I was just watching Pat Hingle as JB is a story of Job. And God was Raymond Massey, and the devil was Christopher Plummer. And Job was, you know, pleading with God, why have you done all these things that you've done to me? And he was so amazing in it. And so I would watch him every night and just react and respond to him. And then I would explore things like, I would go lie in the crack of the cold doorway to feel what it was like to be cold. And then the next night I would work on it in a sensory way to see if I could recreate the cold. And it was just an amazing learning experience to me. And I mean, I was just blessed with that part.
Well, how was the cast to you? Were they nice?
Oh, yes. They were wonderful.
I love Christopher Plummer.
I didn't get to know him, but I got to know Pat Hingle. I mean,
I like him. I've seen him in a lot of stuff.
I mean, he really kind of took me under his wing, and I remember him saying something to me like, Lane, don't let acting become a problem or drudgery, because you're so natural and you're so spontaneous, and I want you to keep it that way. And then when we were out of town, in Washington, D.C. over Thanksgiving, and so he asked me to have Thanksgiving with him and his wife and his family. So he kind of took me under his wing a little bit, which was so sweet.
That is sweet. How long did you do that play?
I was in it for, I think, 7 months, And then I auditioned for Gypsy and got and then got eventually into Gypsy. So I left it to, and went right into Gypsy.
The original. And you were the original June. And
well, I wasn't the original. Oh. I auditioned for it and I didn't get the part. But about 6 weeks later, my agent, Peter Witt, called me and said that they wanted for me to replace the original Dainty June. And so I learned three songs, two dances, a whole lot of dialogue, how to twirl batons, and the time step, which was certainly not in my ballet repertoire, in 3 days.
Wow.
And then went on in Philadelphia after they had been, I guess they had been open a couple of weeks or something. I don't know. That those details leave me.
And you starred, the big old star there was Ethel Merman.
Right.
Miss Grand Dame. How did she treat you? How was Ethel?
Ethel Merman never looked me in the eye. She only looked at my forehead.
Ooh, so, I hate that. That's so creepy.
Well, I mean, I think probably the reason she's a totally, she sets apart and then she doesn't want to be thrown, I think. But it was very discombobulating. And she was, so for me, she was hard to work with because she wasn't there.
No, so, looking at your forehead, I remember a movie I saw and it gets me so upset because this woman, and she got nominated for Best Supporting Actress, is looking at this man she's supposed to be in love with, and she's looking at his forehead the whole time. It drove me nuts. Did you? So, obviously, you were not best buds with Ethel.
No, I was not. I mean, I might as well not have been there, you know.
So she totally ignored you when you were off stage.
I never saw her.
Who played
Gypsy?
Yeah,
Sandra Church.
Did you get along with her?
I got along with her. We were both in the studio. We were both studio members. But you know, we weren't friends. But we weren't enemies.
Yeah,
you know,
you just didn't connect. You weren't on the same wavelength.
And then later, we were both interviewed for this Jerry Robbins thing that they were doing on TV. And so we met and we talked and we got along so well. You know, just telling that it was horrible for her and it was horrible for me, Gypsy was.
Because of Ethel?
No, because, okay, I'll just tell you this teapot story. Mm-hmm. I guess because I went into Gypsy so fast, I was constantly trying to play catch up. Mm-hmm. And there was this scene with Ethel Merman in the Chinese restaurant where she swept some, she was stealing silver and she needed to sweep the silver off the table into her pocketbook. And in order for her to make a clean sweep, I had to move this little teapot. Well, one night I forgot to remove it and I got a note. Then I forgot to remove it another night and I got another note. And then there was an announcement on the loudspeaker that there will be a teapot rehearsal for Lane Bradbury in the lobby tomorrow at 4:00. So at 4:00, I met with the stage manager. We sat around a little table. He said Jack Klugman's line, "Rose, did it ever occur to you that not everybody likes Chinese food?" I moved the teapot. He moved the teapot back. Rose, did it ever occur to you that not everybody likes Chinese food? I moved the teapot. He moved the teapot back. This went on for over a half an hour. That is all I could concentrate on in Gypsy. And then it came to be our last night in Philadelphia before coming back to New York for one preview and opening night. I was in the wings before going on saying, remember to remove the teapot, remember to remove the teapot, remember to remove the teapot. But I guess I was concentrating so hard on remembering to remove it that I didn't hear Jack Klugman's line. I went off stage after the scene. I started up to my dressing room. Jerry Robbins was standing in the stairwell looking down at me. You fucking little bitch. I mean, the life went out of my body. I knew I'd forgotten it again. I had to go past him to my dressing room to get changed for the Broadway number. He smashed in the door. He grabbed my red lipstick. Remember to remove the fucking teapot, wrote on my mirror.
Oh, my God.
And then so after the Broadway number, I turn up stage to go and get my batons off the train caboose for the big finish, and they're gone. I went running off stage to the stage manager. What happened to my batons? Jerry Robbins stepped out from the shadows. I stole them to teach you a lesson.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, it was not. The stage manager would announce whenever Jerry was going to be in the theater. And something would always happen. I would do something wrong. So I finally said, please don't announce when he's going to be in the theater. Please. I mean, the sad thing was he was somebody that I had idolized as a child. And something just went wrong, you know.
And then kaput. So how long did you do it on Broadway?
Well, I was in it. Because I went in it so soon, I mean, because I went in it late,
right?
And they were desperate for somebody. My agent got me, I think I made $250 a week, which was unheard of.
That's good moolah when you it's
at the end
a few grand that now so, probably yeah.
And he got me a 6 month contract, so. When I'd been in it 7.5 months, I pulled something in my leg doing the split, and I had to be out for a week. And then I went to the stage manager, and I said, I'm okay, I can come back in. And he said, take another week, and just to be sure. And then David Merrick fired me for being absent too long.
Oh, my God. So that was sort of their plan.
Yeah, and then because they could get my understudy for $150 or something. You know, so it was just what that's show business, the dark side of show business.
And you learned it so young, you know, just, but it's amazing you got that part, but it's that is a creepy side. So after you did that, is that when you did Night of the Iguana? And you played Charlotte?
Yeah. Then I didn't work for a while. And then, I auditioned for Night of the Iguana, and I got the part. I mean, that was the hardest. That was so hard because I had to go on hysterical every single night. And if you're not hysterical, it's phony. The audience knows it. You know it. So, and there was no, so I just had to prepare every single night doing everything I'd learned at the studio, you know, to do this part. And it's really made me very shy now about going into something where the emotional drainage is so hard because it's the hardest thing I ever did, because if I wasn't full, if I wasn't hysterical, the audience knew it. The scene fell flat. And the other thing that was so bizarre was that I guess because Tennessee Charlotte is talked about from almost the beginning of the play, and then you see her. And so the scene, everybody laughed at my scene with when I'm trying to get Shannon to be with me, you know. And at the first time I heard that, it shocked me so much, because here I am going through the tortures of the damned and the audience is laughing. But if they didn't laugh, it meant the scene fell flat. Isn't that a funny thing?
It is. And you're all tortured. They're laughing their heads off.
I still don't understand it, but that's just the way it was.